I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar
mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
All right, so.
The hell episode is this, Charles?
62.
All right, go with that then.
All right.
Are you still the Jew?
I am.
Okay, I'll still be the Gentile then, because people are starting to associate that correctly now.
Well, that's good.
We're almost to 500 followers on Twitter.
I know. Yeah. Well, we lost some when the Russian bots got taken out, and then we lost some when we posted pro-life, let's do something about guns that do nothing but kill people stuff.
Right. But, you know.
What?
Otherwise,
we're fine.
We're huge in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, and Indonesia now, too.
Well, it was bound to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Like an unholy virus. We just spread.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell, this is episode 62.
Right.
Welcome into our podcast. And we try to discuss everything from the sarcastic to the profane, or at least we are sarcastic and profane and use lots of profanity.
Often at the same time.
I'm Charles Breton, the Jew, and Chris Henson.
We already did that.
Okay, still being a Gentile. We do want you to know that besides our website and iTunes and iPods and wherever else you're getting your
podcasts, the interweb,
we were also available
at
theologycorner.net. And we do want to just take a moment and tick off our sponsors, the people.
Maybe reword that. We don't really want to tick any of them off, but.
Well, I'm ticking them off my list.
And okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, context.
Yeah, context. It's everything.
Well.
So, Men of the Beard Oil, and the wonderful Pastor Nar, Christian Shaman. Virgil Cane Whiskey, not just their rye whiskey, but the ginger infused makes
that was
incredible old fashions.
Ginger-infused bourbon.
Oh, so good. Pipe and Pint.
The one on Spring Garden?
The one on Spring Garden in
Greensboro.
And some of the best beer you ever have is coming out of Asheboro, North Carolina, Four Saints Brewing Company. Joel and Adam are doing a great job. We love their beer. We love going in. In fact, we're going to be there in a few days because it's Beer and Hymns, first Sunday of the month.
You're in the Asheboro area.
Come on by. It's a lot of fun, and the beer is excellent, and so are the hymns. That's because I don't sing.
Well, yeah, you just keep getting ticked off. Is it always about blood and killing this one guy? Or at least that was the critique at Beer and Hymns at Wild Goose Festival, where we're slated to be back on the docket for podcasting this summer.
Yeah. Well, it's not just that hymns are always about blood and killing this one guy. It's you guys sing about killing Jews a lot, well, at least one.
You know what? Now, that's a less anti-Semitic way of looking at it.
Yeah. No. Well, I know you're at home. We're Zooming here. So you're not smoking at the moment. But you had some good cigars over the weekend.
I did.
What's good?
Well, I mean, I had two this Saturday. One was we've already reviewed, the Esteban Carreras Brownstone, which is just, you know, it's an excellent cigar.
It's addictive.
But, well, it's like they put something in it. So we went to our home away from home, or one of our home away from homes, the Top Leaf Cigar Lounge in Winston-Salem. And they just got in an Oscar Valladares Cicerone edition.
I had one also. Very good.
Right.
So what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's so just kind of the release on it. The Cicerone edition is released with five pieces of art selected for the boxes. So even the boxes are collector's items. And each version got a release of 500 of those boxes, each containing 20 cigars. So it's a limited edition smoke. And it came out in the January. So it's fairly new on the market. I know JR was carrying it. But we had it at Top Leaf. It's an Ecuadorian sun-grown wrapper, and most of what Oscar Valladares does is more Honduran. And so, from what I understand, and this is was not, which is kind of a step away from their norm. This is the same guy that brought us the Leaf cigar. It's wrapped in a tobacco leaf, and it's got various sizes. And anyway, if you've seen one of his cigars, that's likely it. So Ecuadorian sun-grown wrapper and the binder and filler are sourced from Nicaragua. So, you know, limited edition goodness there. Tasting notes. It was a very medium-bodied cigar, but it changed up some. You know, there were cream notes, bread and butter notes, exchange of white and black pepper, kind of a wood-type taste, not quite cedar, but getting in that neighborhood. Nuts, and then, you know, I was trying to find the word that fit, you know, that Nicaraguan organic, earthy kind of flavor.
Fecund.
Fecund. Yeah, I mean, fecund.
That sounds like the perfect word for it.
I was going to go with wheat. It kind of has that wheat cracker kind of taste.
Are you calling me a cracker?
No, it's what fecund means.
Okay.
Is that like fertile?
Fertile, organic, rich. Yes.
Oh, okay. So Sarah post visit by God and promise to Abraham.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's fecund. God. Well, I didn't know. I went to an engineering school. Charles, what the hell are you? You know what? No, the hell with that. You sat in front of me the last time we smoked. I know I put that on the podcast, but I'm still thinking about that. I was like looking over there like, oh my God. But you didn't make it up. You gave me one of the
I gave you one of the classic LFT Double O'Haros pre
2004-ish, we think 3-ish.
Well, it's definitely older than 2009 because that's when they switched to their new band.
Right.
So it's at least 10 years old.
Good thing my people have grace because otherwise All right, that's sarcasm. What are you smoking, Charles?
I'm smoking a variant of the Esteban Carrera Chupacabra, which
you had that Saturday as well. Sunday by the time you finished it, but
yeah, this is no. I showed it to you then, but I'm smoking it now.
Oh,
okay. I saved it for the podcast. I saved it to special people, all our fans in Sri Lanka who are listening to this. So this is the Chupacabra Hellcat, which came out in 2016. It's got a San Andreas Mexican wrapper, not the Maduro,
right?
But the sun-grown and Nicaraguan binders and fillers, which Carrera uses a lot. And it's box press, which you know I love. Pigtail at the top, unfinished foot at the bottom. So they certainly save some money. Not finishing the foot, but paid extra money to get the really nice pigtail on the top. It has the things that you would expect from a good Nicaraguan in that it's got that leathery sort of cocoa espresso kind of taste to it, that earthiness you talked about. But it also has some nice sweetness, almost like a creamy sweetness to it. And also those nice pepper, black pepper notes that just come in and out. And like the Chupacabra itself and just about anything from Esteban Carrera, it's very complex. A lot of different flavors coming in and out of it. You know, sometimes you get a little bit more the dark coffee, sometimes a little bit more of the leather. That black pepper at times will be in the background and then it'll come more forward. So very nice, a lot of smoke. Well constructed, and am enjoying this immensely.
Yeah, I was a fiend for the Chupacabra when it first came out.
Oh yeah,
it's hard to walk past that cigar in any humidor and not pick up one or 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I've enjoyed the Brownstone and that line, and I have not had the Hellcat yet. But
no, I recommend it.
Saw it from across the room.
Yeah,
much like I saw that pre 2000 Hoya de Monterrey Excalibur. The last podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Except it was easier to sit on the other side of the room with the cigar that you're reviewing this week.
Yeah, maybe we should have saved the 1066 when we weren't in the same room.
Right.
Yeah, that would have been nice. That's probably why I didn't do it.
Right.
Because it would have been nice.
So if we haven't ticked off all our sponsors, maybe we should plug one of them in one of our commercial type settings and then come back and maybe talk about something. I don't know.
Okay. Let's do that.
All right. We'll be back after these messages.
And talking about God.
Likely.
The Pipe and Pint is the Triad's oldest brick-and-mortar tobacconist and specialty store. It's located in the heart of beautiful Greensboro, North Carolina, at 3716 Spring Garden Street, boasting the Triad of the North Carolina's largest selection of new and estate pipes, rare tobaccos, premium cigars, a favorite of the Jew and a Gentile, and accessories, all while complemented by many of the world's most sought-after wines and over 400 craft beer selections. Again, that's the Pipe and Pint, Greensboro, North Carolina, 3716 Spring Garden Street.
Okay, we're back. So, Charles, we've been talking about, you know, within our blog and podcasts for a number of years now, and then more than that, actually, if we're just, you know, conversation about the identity of God and how that relates to, promoting mental wellness, mental health. And we've been reading a lot lately, and I don't know that I can frame it as a Gentile, but that we limit our understanding of God to where it does violence and harm to our own, to our bodies and minds and sort of our general well-being by limiting. And so,
yeah, no, I agree with you. I've been seeing this tendency as we've been reading, and it certainly is in a lot of the things that we've been reading over the past few years on mental health specifically, but also suffering in general. But I'm even seeing it just in normal sort of posts about faith. People having just very, very limited views of God. And one of them that seems to come a lot is, you know, you see a lot in the literature surrounding mental health and suffering, the idea of God being absent, of God not being present.
Right.
And it seems to always be in this context that, well, not only is God love, but the only thing God is love. And so if I'm feeling not loved, then God is absent.
Well, and love by many Christians is never really fully defined or certainly not agreed upon.
Yeah, it seems to be, you know, that means if I'm only having good things and I'm loved.
But yeah, we're going to take that bit from James, letter to James, and that's going to be it.
Yeah.
Simply the God is love.
Yeah, and that, like you were saying, I think that's some of the suffering that we inflict on ourselves when we put God into that small of a box. That, you know, that this is the only thing that God is, rather than saying everything that God is. And then you add on to it that angst of, so why am I alone? Why have I been abandoned? Why don't you love me, God?
Right. And I was driving home from our last big smoke, and, you know, well, basically between Top Leaf and the Cigarage, it occurred to me that the real deficit for Christians is that they either are very unaware of or completely unaware of that we don't have a Job in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a book or passage that deals in as detail and depth as Job does, and then doesn't bother to clean it up and give it a nice happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Just is.
And Lamentations.
Right.
And a lot of Psalms. Which people assume is in the New Testament, but
Well, the Gideons put it there. They're little half-sized books, and, you know, you should have seen them in our hotels and stuff. 2 Corinthians, huge book.
Huge. I hear a lot of good things from them. The church in Corinth, I've heard good things. You're going to see good things coming out of there.
So,
For me, it's, you know, you're putting yourself in a difficult position when you're insisting that God is only love. First of all, my reaction Jewishly is...
Is that a word? That is now.
What? Reaction?
Jewishly.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Is, it's real that God is never absent. and what you're experiencing is not God's absence, but your feeling of God's absence, not being aware of God's presence. But again, it's because you've limited what that presence means. You know, because we're insisting that, well, God's presence is only the presence of love. And so anytime there's an absence of love, God is absent.
Right. It's huge with mental illness is people that mm-hmm. are people of faith feel like I've done something wrong and I'm being punished. Right. Or if I could only get to be more faithful, pray more, go to church more, read the Bible more, my depression's going to go away.
Right. Prove to God I'm lovable.
Right. And it, all those things may prove helpful in achieving some sort of wellness, but that kind of goes back to the whole, you know, well, if you want to win the lottery, you got to buy a ticket. Again, we limit that love's going to just come in and lift us out of our depression and nothing else is going to change. Yeah. I'm sure there are probably instances where that's happened, but I'm only saying that because, you know, it's a cognitive distortion to be absolute, always black and white, all or nothing.
True.
And, but I doubt it very seriously that it, that and that alone.
Oh, I'm absolutely. And that's why I think this is something that, You can't address this if you're in the midst of it. You know, if you're in that depressive state or you're in that moment of suffering, that's not the time to be doing this. My point is that when you have those moments when you're healthier in your life and you're functioning as we appear to be, that's when you have to rearrange what your concept of God is and enlarge it. So that when you are at those places where you're feeling an absence, then it's not in that dark, well, see, I'm so unlovable, God doesn't even love me. I'm so broken, not even God is here with me.
Right. And it's such a limited, I mean, for first of all, for Christians on this, this is an early dualist heresy, Marcionism. That, you know, there's the God of the Old Testament, then he has kids, he mellows out, and different God in the New Testament, which is completely at odds with a Jewish Jesus and at odds with, you know, the earliest scriptures we have and that comprise the New Testament. And it's a fairly modern invention. And it certainly, as they say, no heresy ever goes away. It just gets repackaged.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also part of my contention of, you know, that in a sense there is no Jewish theology. Rabbis and commentators on Torah don't spend any time discussing, you know, what is God and proving God's existence. Yeah, we take as the basis of the whole faith that God is, and when we talk about God, we focus more on what God does than what God is. And so, you know, if you start with that God is, you're starting with a much broader, fuller image of God than just God is love or God is fill in anything in there. Okay. And so I went back and familiarized myself again with the one sort of theological statement on this. There is this idea of these 13 attributes of God, which is also referred to as the 13 attributes of mercy, because it's not these are things that God is, it's these are things God does, and one of them is show mercy, and there's 13 ways in which that is done. And I think that's an important way of looking at expanding. Well, even if you want to say that God is love, mercy certainly has to be part of that love, right?
One would hope.
Yeah. And so I think if we add this in, then we can expand this and say, you know, that God is present and that it's God's mercy and not God's love.
Well, and it's so, and you're probably going to mention this anyway, but I think maybe it needs to come from me. This is an idea that's been bounced around quite recently with all the rise of neo-Nazis. I mean, the the German Christians, you know, Deutsche Christen, big right. Marcionites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's, you know, that we only want sort of the positive Christianity. And so there's a real danger morally, ethically, spiritually, in any way that you can exist in ignoring that. And I, you know, and so I say that, and then if I'm trying to discuss this with a Christian, and I use that term in quotes, scare quotes, as it were, and all they're going to look at is the New Testament. Well, even if you just stop the search there, God is love, you're going to have to rectify that with the oldest gospel being Mark, and Jesus' last words are, "Why have you forsaken me?"
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't go on to finish the psalm that you probably haven't read, but you probably read the one that comes after it. You know, 22nd right. psalm.
Yeah.
And the 23rd
psalm. Or the whole psalm when it gets to the realization that God has not abandoned the speaker.
Right.
God is always present.
So here's my thing on this. And it kind of goes into my own personal experience. I like the image of Elijah, you know, after he's whooped the prophets of Baal, ball, or how you say it. He's beat the hell out of them. I mean, we're talking, you know, a slaughter. Yeah,
literally.
Literally beat the hell out of them. I mean, he had all the reason in the world to feel confident, to feel competent, and all these things. But where do we find him next? He's under a broom tree praying to God to die. If there's anybody that, and I can relate to being under the broom tree.
Mm-hmm.
But following from that sort of experience is, I think for Christians, we want to see God, you know, Elijah goes into, was it a cave? And there's a big thunderstorm. There's an earthquake, you know, just dogs and cats living in peace, mass hysteria, and all that noise and all that drama. God isn't present. It's the still small voice.
Right.
The still small voice for me when I was a psych patient, I agree with you. I couldn't realize when I was in Job's position, I couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. I was too sick, too hurting. And I don't think anybody realistically could have pointed that out any earlier than I wanted to see it. How the still small voice or the presence and identity of God was in people like yourself and Mrs. Dr. Future Rabbi Jew. My wife, my kid, people that came in to visit at lunch, people that made sure I hadn't offed myself when I was at home. It's those little presence of people created in God's image that carry that identity of being created in God's image into my life at my lowest. So some of it is literally being like Job's friends up until they open their damn mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, and that's how I experience it. And that's the simplest way. Since we thought about this idea to talk tonight, that's the only way I can conceptualize it that I think might make sense to someone who is struggling. And I say that and I want to withdraw because I was blessed isn't the right word because it implies that somebody else isn't. But I was fortunate, lucky to have all those people I could name as resources. And that's not oftentimes the experience of many people with mental illness.
Absolutely, I'm with you on that, and I think that's part of the lesson of Job, but also the difficulty that Job offers, because Job, God does answer out of the whirlwind, and so we sort of anticipate, oh well, that's the model. So when I get really, really bad and I'm suffering, there's going to be this whirlwind, and that's where God's going to answer me. And when it doesn't happen, oh my gosh, God is absent. And
right.
You have to concentrate to hear that still small voice. But this is also why I want to say, yeah, we've always talked about, and everyone who's touches on this subject, and there's a lot of people who do, talk about how these are things that in the moment you cannot do.
Right? No.
And that's why I'm saying this is why we need to do it now.
Well, and I think this defines the role of people of faith who are well.
Right.
But even for somebody to ask you, go be present.
But also for those of us who this is a constant everyday thing.
That's true.
Those moments of clarity that we have, like you and I are seeming to have now.
Good thing we were recording it, otherwise.
Yeah, otherwise no one would believe it happened.
Right.
But these are the times where you have to take your concept of God and not just say, oh well, okay, I've gotten through it and now I'm going back to this old way of thinking again. no, this is when you have to say, well, it was that still small voice. There is something more to God than just speaking out of the whirlwind. Theophanies are not always big, miraculous, booming things.
Right. Not everybody gets knocked on their backside on the road.
Right.
The masses.
So I need to strengthen myself now, just as right now I'm taking medication, just as right now I'm doing other things to stay healthy. I need to create a healthier faith that will sustain me a bit longer when those moments of feeling of absence are there.
I tell you what helped me was, and just to speak to the benefit of this relationship, is my sort of I could tell you what theology was. I could teach it. I could preach it. But when it come down to my own personal beliefs in those moments of crisis, I tended to retreat into a more infantile faith. Mm-hmm. What was helpful was I had plenty of people that could say, well, you know, pray harder, brother. And people I don't talk to anymore. Right.
I don't blame you.
And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to off myself here. Maybe we do something a little more, I don't know, incarnate, hands-on. It seems to be a big thing with Christians, or at least with Christ. I got sidetracked. No, it was looking, reading through stuff like Rabbi Kushner's, you know, I mean, it's a classic, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And I didn't get very far into it before, you know, he makes this, what for me in that present state was a huge kind of epiphany that, no, I wasn't knocked and blinded and something like scales came over my eyes, like Paul, but it was this realization when he said, you know what, maybe how you understand the almighty, the all-powerful, the all-good presence of God, what if that, you just got it wrong. Mm-hmm. There was more to it than that. And I'm nuancing that a little. He says it
right.
Infinitely better and in a whole lot less words.
Yeah. And that's why he gets the big
bucks. That's not a heresy. Not a heresy. That's not the right word. But that's something that's very uncomfortable for Christians to do, especially mainline Protestant.
Yeah. But to some, they would call it a heresy, which I think is the shame of it. And just from my personal experience, I did not, and I still don't, even in some of the worst depressive episodes I've had, I was still talking with God. Now, of course, I was talking and saying, you know, this would be really nice if I didn't wake up tonight. Do you think you could arrange that for me? But
that's still an honest prayer.
Yeah.
That's where you're at?
Yeah. But I think it's because I had this different understanding of God as being more than just love and goodness. For Judaism, it's more, for us, it's a God of mercy and justice, which love is a part of, but a part of, not the entirety. And with that, I never felt abandoned. I never felt that this was punishment. I was able to carry God with me and focus that, all right, these are things I need to do. I need to seek this help. I need to accept this help. I need to take these medications. I need to do these things. And that's why I think if we take some time and talk about what this broader idea of God is, and I know it's shared in Christianity, it is in the scriptures, it is in the theology, and we'll talk in a moment why I think that this was the detriment of Christianity becoming westernized, is that some of this was lost because, you know, Jews have a very complex image of God. Okay. And yeah. Americans in general like simple answers.
And well, it's either that or the Pollyanna gospel.
Well, because we like things to be simple and clear and good. And so much of the presence of God gets washed out in that Americanization of Christianity. Because if God's the answer, then it's got to be an easy, quick answer.
Well, see, that for me, that's even weirder for and this is not what Methodists haven't cornered the market, but part of our theological method is what you believe, does it gel with what you're actually experiencing? And so, yeah. I found a quote that Eli Wiesel, who certainly could speak to suffering and the absence of God, and I don't know if this is from Knight or what work, but this the quote is, and it just kind of felt like it connects with what we're talking about. I have not lost faith in God. I have moments of anger and protest. Sometimes I've been closer to him for that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, would have been a great quote to hear about 4 or 5 years ago when I was in the throes of depression. But again, you probably could have read that to me. Hell, you may have. And it'd have fallen on deaf ears.
Yeah. And so we got to do this now. And that's, I think, part of a tradition of the, quote, Old Testament God that Marcionism has succeeded in not necessarily removing, but at least disguising or camouflaging in Christianity. So it's missed a lot. There's also a great Pirkei Avot, and because I'm not an almost rabbi like my son and wife, I don't remember the rabbi, but he says he has a dream and he's standing before God, and God says, what do you pray for? And the rabbi says, I pray that you will be a merciful God. And the rabbi says, and God, what do you pray for every morning? And God says, I pray that your prayer comes true. Yeah. So the idea, first of all, that this rabbi can question God, what do you pray for? And that God is also desirous of being merciful. It's sort of the same thing that Wiesel is saying, that it's in Judaism, again, because we take at assumption that God is and God will always be and God is always present, that it's fine to that. I think that that's what gets translated into God is absent, is, again, I'm so angry with God. Oh, that must mean God's not present.
Or I'm so angry with God, I've not identified what's wrong, and it can never be
right.
God.
And yeah. And, you know, in anger, God knows that.
That's a dangerous, awkward, uncomfortable feeling for Christians to go.
Exactly. And it's a very, very comfortable for Jews, because it started with Abraham.
God, you're being an asshole.
Yeah.
It's entire books dedicated to people kvetching.
Yeah.
Crying out, lamenting.
Yeah. So...
Do you think some of this is with Christianity? When you were talking about, you know, God's presence, the word that kept coming to my mind is save. God save. We put such an emphasis in some Christianity that it's all about the decision and, you know, then you're saved. Do you think that leads to just this, that just further limits and puts the blinders on as far as God's identity and what God can be about? Is it's always got to be in a salvific function? That's a uniquely Christian idea. It's not.
It is, because it doesn't exist in.
Doesn't exist in the Hebrew scriptures.
Yeah.
And, you know, Christians, I hate to break it to you, but it's a good several hundred years after the death and resurrection of Christ for anybody else sort of making these sort of, the atonement theories. Mm-hmm. And there's more than one of those, but that substitutionary sort of economic, you know, paying the sins type stuff. Yeah, I was preaching that, I was believing that, you know, and that the only reason for Christ's humanity and divinity could only be salvific. There couldn't be any other purpose, such as God just being present, which pretty clear in the few passages we associate with Christmas. Man, mm-hmm. I kick myself now looking back, but I know where I was at that time and how sick I was. Is that I wasn't able to see that. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this question, put in this way. You've read Buber.
I have.
And what is the key feature that moves the I it to the I thou? What is absent in the I thou that is the fundamental connection in the I it relationship?
Well, the I it is that the other is just, it's all about me.
Right. It's transactional.
Right. Well, yeah, because it's what can I get for what I give?
Versus, right. And
everything else is a means to my end, but that's more Heidegger.
No, but that's what we were talking about. It says when you have the I, you're entering into it in a subjective, transactional way. And the reason why the ultimate relationship is our relationship with God, and it's an I-thou, is because it is not transactional. There is no transaction. There's no, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. And so what you've described sounds so much, you know, in terms of, well, my only relationship with God is one of salvation. That is, now again, it's reducing your relationship with God to an I-it. You're now in a transactional, subjective relationship.
I have a question though. And it's one that I think we probably have talked about. I don't know if I've actually named it so much. But some of the ways that theology is taught and understand in Christianity is that within the Hebrew scriptures, and to assure you that they didn't say Hebrew scriptures when they taught this, it was definitely Old Testament. Right. But that there was this sort of Deuteronomic theology where it was sort of reduced down to, if we follow God's rules, good things happen. It seems to be some of that type thinking. I don't even know if that's even an accurate Jewish perspective. It doesn't sound like it because it's way too damn simple. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hold up, at least in, when you talk about the exile and we did everything right and we still lost. I think it's an oversimplification, but saying all that to say that some of that gets transferred into Christianity. We can't do everything to make God happy and follow the rules. So we have to have, you know, Jesus come in and take care of the difference. Mm-hmm. And that's a really shitty way of describing grace. And I don't believe that that's what grace is altogether. Mm-hmm. But is any of that accurate, or is that literally what I think it is, which is a Christian distortion of Jewish thought?
I would say that yes, it is a distortion. But it's a necessary one for Christianity if you're going to insist that the covenant with Jesus supersedes the covenant with Abraham and the covenant with Moses and the covenant with the remnant that returned from exile in Babylon.
Which is ironic because in like the number of the New Testament, the Gospels, Jesus is referred to in the Greek as the telos. Mm-hmm. He's not Marcion's replacement. Kind of things like it's old God. He's got kids. He's remarried.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I say. This is like you were saying historically. This is all happening, you know, generations removed from Jesus's existence on Earth.
Right, and the telos just meaning Christ came, and within Christian context and theology, as a fulfillment of the law and the prophets, not as a replacement. I mean, it's very clear, and which is really cute because a lot of people that would probably have trouble with what we're talking about would remind us that Jesus didn't come to replace even a letter of the law, not one jot, one tittle, which I don't know what a jot is. And
you know, we're too polite to get into
too polite time. To talk about tittles, but yeah, I mean, even, and this is the thing is that I'm sitting here, we're having this conversation. And, you know, from my own perspective, I know a lot about theology. I'll know everything. Theology is ultimately a study of mystery. But I know a lot. And I still fell for some of this. And it did not help my illness. Mm-hmm. And it really, up until fairly recently, I wasn't able to help anybody else through this. Because I was just pissed at God. I didn't trust Jesus. And really, the I didn't trust Jesus had less to do with anything Jesus ever did. It's just the assholes that were his fans. Yeah. I don't really say followers. Like, I love Jesus. Love your Jesus. His followers. Can we talk? I mean, I don't think that sounds like Linda Richman, but I was thinking more like Gandhi. You know, I like your Christ. Not so much your Christians, but I like your Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's for me. What I see is that theology is wonderful when you're healthy. And
yeah,
and it's really shitty when you're not, because I think you hit it on the head. It is such, and I wouldn't necessarily say infantile, but it is a very immature theology.
Well, and I don't know,
very simplistic. And it, like I said, when things are going great, it works, and when things aren't going great, it doesn't. And it, that's where I keep coming, that, that, you know, it's, I think it's important that when you have the capacity to grow and mature your theology, your understanding of God's presence, of what God is, of your relate, but most importantly, it's all about relationship, and it's maintaining the I thou with God. And you know, I think that's where if you know, I come back, if we just start with the 13 attributes of God's mercy. Now there are some issues, and some of them are getting back to my contention that Judaism is a West, is an Eastern religion, but it's in this week's Torah portion, Kita Say, is where we find there's two verses in Exodus, and it's the prayer that Moses exclaims after the golden calf incident, when he's trying to get God not to wipe everybody out. Yeah. He said, and this is Shmot for our Jewish listeners, Exodus for our non-Hebrew speakers, chapter 34, verses 5 through 6. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness and faithfulness, extending kindness to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he does not remit all punishment, but visits the iniquity of parents upon children and children's children upon the third and fourth generations. And from that, the rabbis have extrapolated the 13 attributes of God's mercy. Okay, so Adonai, as opposed to Elohim, this is, Elohim is the God of law. Adonai is the God who is merciful before sin.
But they're the same identity. They're not...
Well, but they're different. It's the same. I see, again, it's the same identity, but it's different things God does. So we have different names for him.
But it's the same God, different functions.
Different, right, because we're looking at what God does. Yeah. And the second, Lord Adonai, God is merciful after the sinner has gone astray. Got a name that denotes power as ruler. Okay, so compassionate. God is filled with loving sympathy for human frailty, but does not put people into situations of extreme temptation and eases the punishment of the guilty. Vachanum, God is gracious. God shows mercy even to those who do not deserve it, consoling the afflicted and raising up the oppressed. Erchapayim, slow to anger, gives the sinner ample time to reflect, improve, and repent. Okay. Varav Chesed, and Chesed is huge. Chesed, kindness. God is kind toward those who lack personal merits, providing more gifts and blessings than they deserve. If one's personal behavior is evenly balanced between virtue and sin, God tips the scales of justice to the good. Emet, truthful. God never reneges on his word. Preserver of kindness for thousand generations. Forgiver of iniquity, whether the sin is intentional or not. Forgiver of error, even if it's careless. So the idea is particularly Chesed and Emet are important, and Chuna, mercy, graciousness. You know, a lot of Marcionite Christians like to talk about the Old Testament God of being a vengeful God, but if you actually read what we call Torah, what is sometimes called Hebrew scripture, you find that God is merciful because justice without mercy is vengeance. You know, this is a much different picture than a God that is simply love. And for me, that an image of a merciful, just God is easier to hold on to in depths of depression, despair, suffering, than a God of love. Okay. Because love, we associate too much with worthiness, right? We have to be worthy of love.
I think Christians also make it sentimental, and that's part of the infantile and immaturity.
Mm-hmm. And it just, I think it leads to the more problems because it's, you know, because God's mercy is not dependent on what we do, because it's a characteristic of God. It's an attribute of God. God is merciful. That God understands we are human and we're going to screw up. But God is patient, slow to anger. Okay, here's opportunities due to Shuva.
Okay. When you were in your darkest moments, you know, and granted, that's different with my episodic or thus far been episodic. What does that look like when you're not in the position to do this kind of thinking and talking? You know, and how is it that, how do you connect in those moments? Or, and connect may not even be the right word. You know, mine was done completely hindsight. I think, you know, to answer that question first for myself is I had to learn to appreciate that grace also meant that I could completely screw it up. And that, you know, and I could be mad as hell, and that I, or more often the case, other people that heard me saying, God's dead, God's not here, all that, God was like really cool with that. He's like, yeah, you're not the first, won't be the last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just not upset, ready to like, I mean, and that was one of the epiphanies is when I just kind of said, how the hell with you? Mm-hmm. You know, I looked up and like, oh shit, I haven't been struck down by lightning.
Right.
But anyway.
Well, having been raised in this environment where this was my concept of God, you know, merciful, compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, it was never an issue. Where God was in my whole process was never part of my thinking because God was never absent. There wasn't anything for me to get angry with God about. It wasn't a, you know, what did I do, God? Why have you forsaken me? That just, not that I'm not a person of faith, and not that I didn't understand this stuff. It was because of my faith that my faith was always, you know, God is still here. The other thing that comes from these 13 attributes also is God's concern for the individual versus God's concern for the community is another.
That's difference. A whole podcast, personal.
It is, because it's a huge difference between Judaism and Christianity.
Personal and private. That's where Christians usually make the mistake.
Right. But also just private. The individual versus the community.
Which is Eastern.
Which is Eastern.
Okay? Yeah.
You know, the verses toward the end of that verse that I read gives a lot of people problem. You know, he does not remit all punishment, but visits iniquity of parents upon children and children's children upon the third and fourth generations. Sounds like a really vindictive, vengeful God.
Or it could be that genetics and environment also contribute to depression and mental illness going forward.
It does, but it's also that it's a community. We're right. Responsible for each other.
Well, and when you're not responsible for each other, you just perpetuate the illness.
Exactly. And when you don't do something, when you see iniquity in your community, you say, well, it's not me. I don't have to worry about it. Yes, you do.
Right. Because, I mean, mental illness, for instance, some research I've been doing is that, you know, we're trying to connect with, you know, homelessness, you know, lack of resources, lack of underinsurance, uninsured. And then people with mental illness, including substance use disorder, mm-hmm. is that the universal problem isn't mental illness. The universal problem in that equation is poverty. And that is right. A community concern.
Right.
And Christians right. especially, no, there's something altogether sacred and holy and faithful about providing health care at affordable rates for people, because otherwise mm-hmm. you're going to still deal with it. You're either going to deal with the symptoms of it or you can deal with the disease.
Right.
And you will not run out of symptoms.
Right. And it's, what did Christ say about the poor?
Who are we asking?
You know, that they will always be with us.
Yeah.
But that's, now there are some people who look at that and say, well, that, you know, of course it will always have poor. There's nothing we can do about it. But if we're taking it from this perspective, what he's saying is, yeah, as long as you keep doing what you're doing, there's always going to be poor. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, Jesus is not giving a statement so much as, this is a problem.
Right.
Keep doing this shit.
Right. And you're responsible for them. They're in. Right. They're part Matthew of your community.
Taking care of the least of these includes those with mental illnesses. You know, there was a great article in Sojourners, I think December, January issue, available online. We can put it in the podcast notes. Jesus, when did we see you an addict? Mm. And it's going into the presence of the church in response to the opiate crisis, which is a mental illness issue and is most definitely a poverty issue too.
Yeah.
It is a community response. You're not going to arrest your way out of this problem. You're not going to legislate your way out of this problem. And I'll be bold enough to say, and you're not going to pray your way out of this problem. And people go, oh, that's just offensive. It's like, yeah, because thoughts and prayers have worked so well so far. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've gotten off topic a little bit, but yet not.
Yeah. No, not that. Then it's expanding your understanding and then deepening the relationship.
Well, but it's also God. It's also responding to, hello, those out there listening who are mentally well or in a place of wellness and stability, here's some things you could be doing to help those people that are sick and hurting that won't have you coming off as Job's asshole friends. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That'll preach. Not anywhere I would be asked to preach, but, you know.
But, yeah, but certainly.
I'd lose the asshole bit, but.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Could be Balaam's ass, so, you know, that's fine. It's all how you
No, I got to go with a more New Testament image. I'd love to have this on a t-shirt, sticker, something. Who knows? Wild Goose merch. And I can't claim it. I mean, it's actually one that I heard from a Shane Claiborne message that he preached at a youth rally. And he's like, you know, I just want to be I'm probably misquoting him a little bit. But, you know, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem is, I'm not here to be Jesus. I'm just the ass he rode in on. You know, right. I'm a means of conveyance for a greater message.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, we're talking about our shirt, t-shirts for Wild Goose.
Right?
Maybe on the front we could say, you know, I'm not here to cure your mental illness. We're just the two asses who talk about it.
Well, yeah. And we've got references. So,
yeah. Yeah, a lot of people will say we're asses.
So, Charles, do we have any words of wisdom?
I do. I do, because this is Johnny Cash's birthday.
Ah, did you shoot a man in Reno just to watch him die?
I did. That's how I always celebrate Johnny Cash's birthday.
Did you hurt yourself today? That's really not all Johnny Cash.
That's not all Johnny Cash.
Coverage. Cover of it.
What a cover.
He was better to sing that than Trent Reznor ever was.
Yeah. Anyway, so I pulled this from Johnny because a lot of people asked him, you know, he's the man in black and why he wore black. So to celebrate the great John Cash, he said, I wore black because I liked it. I still do. And wearing it still means something to me. It's still my symbol of rebellion against a stagnant status quo, against our hypocritical houses of God, against people whose minds are closed to others' ideas.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from all mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.